You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And boy, is there a lot in the news today. Let's start off with the thoughts, insights, and perspectives of Senator Bernie Sanders, the guy who knows so much about what's going on. He's right in the middle of it. The Independent from Vermont, our Brunch with Bernie Hour. And by the way, Bernie will be taking your call starting in about 10 minutes. So, Bernie, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Always great to have you. So what, you know, I don't know where to start.
Yeah, it's a busy period. Let me go over a few of the issues that I think many of the listeners may be concerned about. The revelations this week that it turns out that as a result of this disastrous USA Patriot Act, which I have consistently opposed from its inception, the government now has a very, very broad program, which is collecting data essentially on the hundreds of millions of Americans. So that if you have a telephone and you're making calls, you can assume that there is a database where those calls, when you made those calls, the phone number you called is on a huge, huge, huge database. That does not mean that anyone is looking at it at the moment. Doesn't mean that anyone is monitoring the calls, because they're not. But it does mean that database is there. And here's what the issue is. I think, Tom, it is not a complicated issue at all. I happen to believe that terrorism is a serious issue. There are people out there who want to do us harm. We saw that at the Boston Marathon. That's real stuff. And we want to be vigorous in opposing that, in destroying any plots that may be against our country. But at the same time, we live in a democratic society. We pride ourselves on liberty, on freedom. That's what we have, it ties to the whole world. And when the United States government now has phone records and records in terms of how you access websites, etc., on hundreds of millions of Americans, 99.9999, go on with the nines, have nothing to do with terrorism, there is something wrong. There is simply something wrong. That's not what freedom is about. That's Orwellian. And I don't accept the excuses from the administration. And they have inherited and expanded these programs from the Bush administration. We expected better from the Obama people. That's the only way you can address the issues of terrorism. So we want what it gets down to is whether or not you need to have records on everybody, or whether or not you do good law enforcement. If there is reason to believe that somebody is involved in terrorism, we want our law enforcement people to be able to go after them. And the way you do that is you go to what's called a FISA judge or an independent judge, and you say, Judge, we have reason to believe. Here's the reasoning A, B, C, and D. If they make a case about probable cause, the court will say, you go get them. But if they don't make the cause, if somebody simply was participating in a demonstration or wrote a letter to the editor, that's not a probable cause to my mind. In any case, you start with the individual who you suspect, not with everybody in America. So that is the key issue there. And I worry about this a whole lot. And again, I think the problems stem from the passage of the Patriot Act and a very, very broad interpretation by the Bush and Obama administration of what they can do. So that's one issue that's out there that's very important. I intend to work with other members of the Senate and the House to see how we can very, very significantly tighten that up and end this type of abuse. Second issue out there, big issue, is immigration. That will probably be coming before the Senate on Monday night or Tuesday. And the issue there is, in my view at least, this is an issue long overdue. It's something we should deal with, I believe, in a path to citizenship for undocumented people in this country. I believe in the DREAM Act. I believe that we need legislation to protect farm workers. We have that issue here in Vermont. It's certainly all over the country. I remember being with tomato workers in Immokalee, Florida a few years ago, probably the most exploited workers in America. They have no rights, and we need to give them legal status. Now, my concern Where I have very strong concerns is that in the midst of a moment when we have such high unemployment in this country, and real unemployment is not 7.5%, it is much closer to 14% if you include people who have given up looking for work and people who are working part-time when they want to work full-time. I just have my doubts as to whether or not through these guest worker programs, the H-1B program, the H-2B program, you really want to bring hundreds of thousands of new guest workers into this country to compete with people who are already not making, in many cases, a living wage or not finding a job at all. So really, do we need people to come from Eastern Europe to serve as lifeguards or to serve as ski instructors in America or to serve as front desk people or to serve as cooks or waitresses or waiters when you have kids in this country who need those summer jobs and jobs in order to pay for college? I have my doubts about that. So it's a complicated issue, but I'm supportive of much of what's in the bill. I want to be supportive of the whole thing. And in the coming weeks, we're going to work on some of these guest worker provisions. Other issues that are out there continue to be the budget, the impact that sequestration is having on seniors and on kids. We have lost some 70,000 slots for Head Start kids at a time when we need to substantially increase the number of early childhood education programs. We're losing them. We have a lot of older Americans out there, senior citizens, who are dependent on the Meals on Wheels program in order to get a decent meal every day, have somebody visit them. We've cut back on that substantially. So I'm the chairman of the subcommittee that deals with the Older Americans Act and Meals on Wheels, and we have put together, I think, pretty good legislation which expands that program, not cuts it back, and protects seniors in the process. In terms of Social Security, which you and I have talked about many, many times, there was a study that just came out, didn't surprise me, from the Economic Policy Institute, making the point that any cuts in Social Security would be devastating to many, many folks in our country, older people, who today are struggling to keep their heads above water economically, having a hard time paying for food or prescription drugs or heating their homes. So we're going to continue our effort to oppose the so-called chain CPI, strongly supported by Republicans, sadly supported by the president. I think, frankly, between you and me, at least short-term, we're going to win this fight. Because at the end of the day, while it may make a good talking point in Washington, D.C., when you talk to billionaires and Wall Street guys about how you got to cut Social Security, when you go out to the people back home, very few people think that that is a good idea. They don't think it's a good idea to cut benefits for disabled veterans as well. So that's an issue where I think short-term we have made some good progress. We've got to keep that fight up. And in terms of the budget, which is, of course, what sequestration is about, the issue remains very, very simple. And that is, at a time when we have growing income and wealth inequality in America, at a time when the middle class is disappearing, we've got 46 million people living in poverty, we have got to have a budget which addresses the real needs of the American people and does not simply cut, 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 and cut. What our Republican friends in the House want to do is continue their assault against Medicare and Medicaid, major, major cuts, basically creating a whole new approach toward Medicare, cutting back on education, cutting back on nutrition. Right now, in Vermont and around this country, you got millions of young people who are really heavily burdened with these college debts. In Vermont, it's about, the average graduate is 28,000. Nationally, it's about 25,000. It's an issue that we have got to address. One way you don't address it is by cutting Pell Grants and other federal aid to higher education.
It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. Brunch with Bernie, right here on the Tom Hartman program. 15 minutes past the hour. Be sure to check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And, of course, you can drop into our free live chat room, blogs, message boards, all kinds of cool stuff at tomhartman.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there. Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, don't think so. chance. It's the Tom Hartman program. Our brunch with Bernie, our Senator Bernie Sanders on the line. Kelly in Lake Havasu City, Arizona, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you, Tom. Senator Sanders, my question for you is, why is there no conflict of interest law in Congress?
There is a conflict of interest law. Kelly, do you want to be more specific on that?
Well, Lawrence O'Donnell the other night had a good piece on that I thought was interesting, because he showed a Republican House member that got on the farm.
Right, right. I'm familiar with that case. Right, a guy who's getting subsidies who.
$3.5 million, and then he talks about holding the purse strings of Congress. Well, what? Huh?
Well, that is a good point. I mean, I think that's a fair question. I think. Too often that ends up falling on the individual who should conflict himself out of those decisions. Somebody should get up there and say, look, I'm involved in this program. I benefit from this program. I'm not going to vote on this issue. And you will find members doing that. Apparently, this fellow in the House chose not to do that. I think when we look at the Congress, however, and that you've raised a good point, fair point, the most important point, never to forget about it, and it's easy to get sidetracked, is the degree to which Congress is dominated by big money, by campaign contributions, and by lobbyists. That is the overwhelming issue as to why we're not addressing the high unemployment rate, why we're not addressing the issue of global warming, why we're not effectively addressing health care and joining the entire rest of the developed world in creating a national health care system. So there are a lot of issues. You could criticize Congress rightfully for hour after hour. The basic issue is Congress addressing the issues and the needs of ordinary Americans, or are they protecting the interests of the wealthy and large corporations? And the answer is the latter. They are protecting the interests of big money, and we got to figure out how we change that dynamic.
Ashes in Palatine, Illinois, listening to WCPT. You're on the air, Senator Sanders.
Well, hi, Senator Sanders. Hi, Tom. Excellent show. I had a question. Senator Sanders, I read in my local newspaper, they carry AP articles all the time. And the AP reporter stated in his article that the change CPI only applies to senior citizens who earn over $100,000 a year. And I read that's what he reported in his article. I want to know, is that true or not?
No, it's absolutely untrue. And I can't believe, I hope that wasn't an AP reporter. No, that's absolutely untrue. It applies to everybody. What I think there may be a few exceptions for the poorest of the poor. And then in later years, for people who are very, very, very old, might not be impacted. No, but the change CPI is, if you are living on $15,000 or $20,000 a year, or $30,000 a year, and you're getting all or three quarters or half of your income from Social Security, the change CPI will impact you. Now, what it will do is, if it were passed tomorrow, it's not going to be, and hopefully it never will be passed, but if it was passed tomorrow and you're 65, what it would mean is you would get a reduction in your benefits, because we would make stingier the cost of living adjustments every single year. If you were 65 today, by the time you were 75, it would mean that you would get $650 a year less in Social Security benefits, which, if you're trying to get by on $15,000 or $20,000 a year, is a lot of money. It means the difference between whether you're going to stay warm or not stay warm in the winter, buy the prescription drugs you need, and so forth and so on. So this, if you read to the contrary, it's just not true. This applies to virtually everybody, and certainly average recipients of Social Security. And we're going to do everything we can to defeat that proposal.
Chase in Santa Cruz, California, watching on our website over at TomHartman.com. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. Yeah, I was wondering, Senator Sanders, how important do you feel foreign aid is as a humane strategy to decrease the unskilled diaspora of developing nations as it relates to their immigration into the United States?
Well, that's a, a complicated question because you're touching on a number of issues. Do I believe foreign aid is important? I do. I think wealthier nations, not just the United States, but other wealthy nations, have the obligation to make sure that children, for example, in Africa, are not dying from treatable illnesses where medicine can cost 50 cents a day and keep kids alive. Do I think we should be involved in that? I do believe so. I think, second of all, it's a good investment. Because when the United States does the right thing, and often we do, when we do things preventing AIDS, for example, and we work with poor people to give them a little bit of money in terms of small loans to start businesses or to help them out with agriculture, the political gains are very significant. People say, well, the United States is on my side. And it counters, I think, some of the extreme groups who want to move toward fundamentalist type governments. So, you know, I do believe that we should be involved from a moral point of view, and both from a political point of view. I think it often makes sense if we do it the right way.
Okay. And you 20 seconds. Any thoughts on where we're going with foreign aid, Bernie? Most Americans think it's so much.
Believe in cutting virtually every program in America, and there's a lot of pressure. I think people don't understand that foreign aid is a relatively small program. People think it's some huge program. It is not. And in fact, compared to many other countries, we are per capita far less generous.
Okay. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. Tom Hartman program. We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders right after this. Sure, check out his website. They update the news there several times a day. You've got the Bernie Buzz, great newsletter. Keeps you up to date on what's going on.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Call 866-987-THOM.
You can find it all over at sanders.senate.gov. 27 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, 34 minutes past the hour. Just a quick FYI, today is a UN Day. We're going to be doing the second and third hours of our program live by ISDN with Talk Radio News Service from the United Nations Ambassador. The Ambassador from Canada is going to be with us. The Ambassador from Norway is going to be with us. The Spokesperson, Senior Media Advisor to UNICEF is going to drop by. And the director of the UN Women's Program is going to be with us. So just a quick heads up. In addition to Anything Goes Friday. But right now it's Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, taking your questions and answering your calls. And Don, in Norman, Oklahoma, you are on the air with Senator Sanders. Don?
Yes, this is Don. I just want to know what we can do as citizens to try to give our children and grandchildren an opportunity to achieve some type of education and economic opportunity.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, Don. I mean, that is clearly one of the great questions on the minds of millions of Americans. It is no great secret that in the last 20 or 30 years, and certainly accelerated by the Wall Street recession of 2008, that we're seeing a middle class in decline, and for the first time probably in the modern history of America, unless we change it, our kids are going to have a lower standard of living than we do. And that is not acceptable. So I think, Don, I mean, you've raised a whole series of questions, but I think for a start, we need to create a jobs program in this country that puts millions of people back to work, and God only knows there's more than enough work to be done from Oklahoma to Vermont, and that is rebuilding crumbling bridges and roads, creating a rail system fit for the 21st century, creating the kinds of water systems and environmental systems that we need. We also have to focus on transforming our energy system away from fossil fuel. I know many of my Republican friends don't agree, but the reality is that global warming is real. It's man-made, largely man-made. It is already causing severe damage, and we have got to help lead the world in cutting greenhouse gas emissions. And when you do that, Don, you also create jobs. But it's not only creating jobs, as important as that is, and rebuilding the middle class. It is also important, vitally important, to make sure that our kids have a quality education. And certainly, right now, for many working class families, the cost of college is just much, much too high. Kids are graduating $25,000 in debt on average, and sometimes if you're a lower income family, it could be double that. And that's just, it's not only wrong, it means that kids just go out into their adult life with this tremendous burden, financial burden on their backs. So we have to figure out how we make college affordable. Right now, by the way, by the end of July, college interest rates on the Stafford loan will double from 3.4 to 6.8 unless Congress acts. I certainly hope and expect that Congress will. But longer term, we've got to make sure that we make college education affordable. A few weeks ago, I had the ambassador from Denmark coming to Vermont. In that country, college education is free. It doesn't come out of the pocket of an individual because they believe it's important that their kids, regardless of income, be able to get the best education they can, all the way up to medical school. We have got to appreciate how important education is if we're going to compete in a global economy. So that's a little bit of what we've got to do, I think, Don.
Leah Marie in Tucumcari, New Mexico. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. The previous caller actually started the question that I was interested in, so I'm just going to try to ask it again. Senator Sanders, if you were king of the world, how would you go about starting rural economic development? You were talking about our sagging infrastructure. If you, were king of the world, how would you try on a nuts and bolts level to get this started?
Okay. Thank you very much, Leah, for asking me. It's a lot of fun to be thinking about that. So you made me just going from a mere senator to king of the world, and I appreciate that. So let me tell you what I would do as king of the world. First of all, I would create a fair and just tax system, which says to the wealthy and large corporations they're going to have to stop paying their fair share of taxes. If you do that, you can bring in substantial amounts of revenue. It could protect the most vulnerable people in this country, but it'll also give us the money to invest in our country. As I indicated earlier, in Vermont, all over this country, we have huge infrastructure problems, roads in bad shape, bridges crumbling, water systems in terrible shape, needing a lot of investment. We have a rail system which is falling way behind Europe, Japan, even China. So we can invest in making our country more productive. Roads and bridges and rail do not get better by themselves. You have to invest in them. You create a whole lot of jobs at all levels, from scientists to engineers down to blue-collar construction workers. That could be a real shot in the arm in terms of creating jobs short-term and also making our country more productive. Also in terms of rural America, there are places in the state of Vermont today, and we're working hard on this, that we're probably leading the country, where you can't get cell phone service, where you can't get high-quality broadband. So all over rural America, we want to make sure that people have access to the Internet. Small businesses can be established in small rural communities. We want to make sure that we're protecting family-based agriculture. We want to make sure that we are transforming our energy system. Farmers around the country today are beginning to make significant sums of money from hosting wind turbines, solar fields, and we've got to work on that. So I think there are a number of short-term approaches that can create a whole lot of jobs, lower unemployment, lower our deficit, and those are just some of the things, Leah Marie, that I would propose.
Sam in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Okay. Hey there, Professor Hartman.
Sam, you're back from your cancer surgery. I hope you're well.
Hey, I am. Praise the Lord. Thank you, Jesus. I'm better.
Great. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Sam?
Yes, sir. Senator Sanders, I want to thank you very much for being an independent party.
Sam, you got to be listening to your telephone, not your TV. There's a delay.
Okay. All right, my question for Senator is, what is austerity, and are we headed that way here in America?
Okay, Sam, thank you very much. That's a very good question. Here's the issue, and it's a funny, Sam asked a very fundamental question, which whose answer I thought had been well understood for the last 70 or 80 years. And we're back to the 1932 presidential election between Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Herbert Hoover. And the approach that Hoover advocated to get the economy moving out of the terrible depression that they were in was austerity, if you like, was cutting federal spending, balancing the budget. And what Roosevelt ended up doing was to saying, no, we've got to invest in the American people. We've got to put people back to work at a time when this country had 20-25% unemployment. So you had all kinds of projects out there, the CCC. You had all kinds of infrastructure projects and projects that ended up putting millions of people back to work and helping us get out of that Great Depression. I had thought that that issue had been resolved, but it turns out I was wrong, that in recent years we still have economists, conservative economists, who think the best way out of recession is to cut. And that's precisely what our Republican friends in the Senate are doing, in the House and certainly in the Senate want to do. And that is, instead of investing in job creation and addressing the serious problems facing our country, and I just rattled off what I thought some of them were with infrastructure and energy, what these guys want to do is to cut back on education, cut back on health care, cut back on infrastructure, and move us aggressively toward less and less spending at a time when we have such high unemployment. We are seeing that debate taking place all over the world. And I think those countries, and I think the IMF recently came out with a report, if I'm not mistaken, that their policies toward Spain were wrong, that they pushed too much austerity, which resulted in unemployment going up. So I do not believe that when the middle class is disappearing, when you have millions of people who are really hurting and they're struggling to stay alive economically, you don't tell those people who are going to make your life even more difficult. What you do is you invest in those people, you invest in this country, you create jobs, you generate more tax revenue, and you move us out of the high unemployment time that we're in.
Yeah, Bernie, just 20 seconds to our break. Do you see any of that coming out of this legislature?
Well, I think I think we are winning, if you like, the political debate. But I think our Republican friends remain absolutely adamant in the desire to give more tax breaks to the wealthy and large corporations. Then they will kind of put that within some kind of philosophical or economic idea that if you give tax breaks to the rich, it makes everybody happy. The answer is a lot of these campaign contributions for them come from the rich. That's what the rich want, and that's what they're doing.
Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, answering your questions in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, here on the Tom Hartman program. Check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for his newsletter, Bernie Buzz.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you can check out our new iPhone and iPad app that's been upgraded for the new Retina display. That's free over at the App Store or over at tomhartman.com. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. The Tom Hartman program. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Steve in Yorba Linda, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Tom Hartman. Thank you for your program. Senator Sanders, thank you for your great work. I have a question that it kind of centers around the idea of maybe it's time to stop nation building in China. Some people might think that's a weird comment, but for decades we've been doing that. And one example is Johnson Controls has 60 factories in China. That's just one major corporation in the United States. My question is, what can the senators do about changing the debate around this economy that's suffering right now and start bringing it to focus on corporate policy and practice?
Steve, great question. I was in China a number of years ago, and it is just astounding. When I was there, you saw just an enormous amount of construction, new factories, and many of them were American or European factories. So what we have seen, Steve, in the last 10 or so years in this country is the loss of about 50,000 or more factories, millions of decent-paying jobs, and a number of those companies have moved to China and other low-wage countries. Now, this has everything in the world to do with our disastrous trade policy, and in this case, permanent normal trade relations with China, which said to companies, hey, no problem. You want to shut down in America. You want to move to China. You want to pay people there 50 cents a buck an hour. That's great. And those products will come back into America. And corporate America that pushed that policy said, great, that's what we want, that's what we'll do, and that's what they did. Now, how do you change that? You change that through trade policy. Here you have an instance, again, when I talked a moment ago about the power of big money in America. In this case, it doesn't matter really whether it's the Democratic leadership or Obama or the Republican leadership and George W. Bush. There has now been accepted by the leadership of both parties that unfettered free trade is a good thing for America. In fact, it's a disaster. It has cost us millions of decent-paying jobs. It has lowered wages in America. So to answer Steve's question, I think you need to change the trade policy. And I got to tell you, I've never voted for one of these trade bills. You have to demand that corporate America start reinvesting in this country, and instead of building factories in China, start building them in the United States of America.
Gus, in New York City, listen to WWRL. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi there. I'm a school teacher, and, you know, I've been teaching for 6 years now in the classroom every day, and I see the devastating results of standardized tests on my kids. They hate school, and the tests this year have been worse than ever because last year they expanded it from 4 days to 6 days. Now, that doesn't count the grading where the teacher is taken out of the classroom and we have subs for another 3 to 5 days. And then if you include the practice tests and all the drilling, we're losing weeks and weeks of learning time because of these standardized tests. So I wanted to ask the senator, because there's going to be a rally tomorrow against Governor Cuomo up in Albany by the teachers. I wanted to ask Senator Sanders if the repeal of No Child Left Behind is on the horizon.
The answer is yes and no. The answer is, in fact, that the ESEA, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, is coming up, and I'm on the committee that deals with it. I believe we start discussing it in the committee very shortly, next week or the following week. So in a sense, it is. I think, at least in the Senate, we have the votes to get rid of some of the more onerous provisions in No Child Left Behind, and I think Gus did a good job in describing some of the results of that. In my view, first of all, I want to thank Gus and all of the other teachers in America. You know, it's so easy, and it happens so often, that we beat up on educators who in many instances, I know in Vermont and around the country, are working really, really hard and effectively with kids, and sometimes under very difficult circumstances where kids come to school hungry and in some cases from dysfunctional families and all kinds of problems. So I want to thank the teachers of this country for doing, by and large, a very, very good job. I think we need educational reform, but not the kind of reform that was in No Child Left Behind. I think we need educational reform to give teachers the flexibility to make school exciting and interesting for kids, not to cut back on the arts or on athletics or cultural activities, not to cut back on those things that make kids excited and want to come to school. I think we have to do a much, much, much better job in terms of child care and preschool education, both for working families and for the children and their ability to do well as soon as they get into school. I think we have to be talking about summer programs. I know in Vermont, and I'm sure many other parts of the country, we have really great summer programs for kids connected to the schools, where kids are both getting recreational activity as well as continued education. I think we have to make it clear to every kid in this country, if you come from a low-income family, a working-class family, you know what? You can go to college. College will be available for you if you do your work. I'm afraid many kids get turned off early on because they know they ain't going to be able to afford to go to college. So there are a lot of things that we have to do, but certainly no child left behind, and teaching for the test, which Gus is talking about, is the wrong approach. So, Gus, we're working on it. As you know, it's a tough climate in Washington right now, but we'll do our best to get rid of some of the onerous provisions of No Child Left Behind.
Bernie, just a little less than a minute to wrap the hour. Thoughts on the week ahead?
Well, you know, I think Mark, a few minutes ago from California, you know, asked the real question that we have to be asking ourselves is, how do we create a more democratic society? How do we get more in people involved in the political process, especially those people who are already bearing the brunt of bad public policy? If you're unemployed, if you're making $8 or $9 or $10 an hour, if you don't have health insurance, you should be actively involved in the political process. And that's, we have to figure out how to make that happen.
Bernie, thanks so much once again this week for being with us.
My pleasure. Take care.
Always an honor. Brunch with Ray. Be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. We'll be back with our UN Day plus Anything Goes Friday. We'll be taking your calls and alternating them with our guests from the United Nations.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. In the next segment, we're going to have the ambassador from Canada. He's going to be with us. Canada's ambassador and permanent representative of the United Nations. Actually, the ambassador to the UN, not to us. Guillermo Ryszynski, I believe, is the name. But right now, it's Anything Goes Friday. So, moderator's privilege, I just want to engage in a short rant here. President Obama, first of all, let me just share with you from Article 2 of the Constitution. Article 1 is about, you know, the House and Senate. Article 2 is the president. Article 3, of course, is the courts. And Article 2 specifies what the president shall say when he is sworn in. So this really is the definition of his job. I do solemn, before entering on the execution of his office, he shall take this is Article 2, Section 1, Sentence 8. Before entering on the execution of his office, he shall take the following oath or affirmation. Quote, I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of the President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Period. End of quote. Now, I don't read anything in there about his number one job being defending us. It says his job is to defend the Constitution. Well, here's what the president had to say about this massive data sweep that's going on that started with the Bush administration that his administration has been continuing.
You know, when I came into this office, I made two commitments that are more important than any commitment I make. Number one, to keep the American people safe. And number two, to uphold the Constitution.
I think he's got them backwards. I mean, I'll just say it. I think he's got them backwards. Your job, sir, is to uphold the Constitution. And if that makes us less safe, as Ben Franklin said, those who would give up a little essential security or a little essential liberty in exchange for a little essential security, deserve neither. The president went on to say, and now Ben Franklin was quite black and white about this, you know, you either have freedom or you have security. Your choice. Here's what the president said today.
I specifically said that one of the things that we're going to have to discuss and debate is how are we striking this balance between the need to keep the American people safe and our concerns about privacy, because there are some trade-offs involved.
yeah. Jeff Merkley, by the way, has essentially rebutted that. He says, no, not so much. Jeff Merkley, good man. This also is what the president had to say about this. Again, you know, suggesting that, you know, we got to, you know, balance this stuff out and figure out the appropriate way and all that kind of thing. And here he is.
And the modest encroachments on privacy that are involved in getting phone numbers or duration without a name attached and not looking at content, that on, you know, net, it was worth us doing. That's
that's his opinion. And, you know, perhaps he's right. If they're just looking at phone numbers and duration and they're not looking at, but why bother? If you know, if Tim McVeigh is calling the Michigan militia on Thursday at 4:03 p.m., wouldn't you want to know what they said? And on the other hand, if Joe Blow is calling Jane Doe, I mean, who cares? So it seems like you do it the old-fashioned way, you know, the constitutional way, the Amendment 4 way. Somebody comes forward, presumably a law enforcement officer, and says, I believe that a crime is being committed, has been committed, or is about to be committed. I have some evidence to back that up, and I am willing to swear under oath that what I say is true. Says that to a judge. Now, law enforcement officer is the second branch of government. That's executive. Says that to a judge. That's the third branch of government. And under laws specified by the first branch of government, Congress, that judge issues a warrant so that the second branch of government, the executive, can then snoop on that person who may be committing a crime. That's how it's supposed to be done. I have no problem with that. I have no problem with wiretaps. I have no problem with data sweeps. As long as it's been approved by a judge and that the judge approved it because somebody swore under oath, you know, this is the Fourth Amendment, because somebody swore under oath that they believed that there was probable cause, that a crime was happening. Let me just, again, the Fourth Amendment is a single sentence long. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects. And I'm sure if this were written today, that would include computers. Papers and computers are probably indistinguishable. Telephones and computers are probably indistinguishable. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. And no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation. And particularly, in other words, specifically, describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized. Now, I don't see any ambiguity in that. But we have, you know, a multi-hundred billion dollar, if not over decades, certainly a trillion dollar now military industrial security complex. It has taken on a life of its own. It has become the tail that's wagging the dog of Congress and of the executive branch. And I think I can speak for many of my conservative talk show host colleagues, and I ran across a whole bunch of them yesterday. Thank you. Dr. Mike filled in for me yesterday. Thank you, Dr. Mike, while I was at the Talkers Convention in Washington, D.C., the Talk Radio Convention, watching Glenn Beck, of all people, get the Freedom of Speech Award as he held up the bloody napkin that Adolf Hitler was wearing when the assassination attempt happened, and he said, "Here's Hitler's blood." Yes, quite proud. Although he did, Glenn Beck actually gave a decent speech, but that part was the creepy part to me. But in any case, I talked with a number of right-wing talk show hosts yesterday, and of course, they're freaked out about this, opposed to it. They weren't when it was Bush, many of them. Now they are. It's Obama. Maybe that's what it's going to take. It's going to take a Democratic president doing these kind of things to get the traditional right wingers, the traditional, government should be in our bedrooms and they should be listening to our phone calls. They just shouldn't be taxing us. So-called conservatives on board. We'll see. There's a lot of kind of incoherence and inconsistence on the right, but this seems to be the sort of thing. You know, the massive sweeping up of information by our government of people who nobody has suggested have committed crimes. Nobody has sworn an oath or affirmation that this person has committed a crime. This, I'm guessing, is the area where, and it'll be interesting to see what my colleagues have to say on the left. You know, are they just going to come out and say, oh, well, hey, you know, a Democratic president is doing it, must be just fine. I'm a big fan of President Obama in a lot of regards. He's done a lot of good things. This, in my opinion, is not one of them. And hopefully this will lead to something like the Church Committee hearings, which were held back in the Nixon era, where Congress finally put their foot down and said enough.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I mean, let us not forget, Congress is what brought us this. This is the thing. What Obama did is not illegal. It was authorized by laws passed by Congress during the Bush administration. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, and live from the United Nations, Canada's ambassador and permanent representative to the United States is on the line with us. And, sir, at the risk of mangling your name, would you pronounce your name for us, please?
Sure, absolutely, Tom. Guillermo Ryszynski.
Okay, Gelmer Ryszynski.
Guillermo.
Okay. And CanadaInternational.gc.ca, the website. Sir, what's on your plate right now from the Canadian point of view with regard to the United Nations? What are the issues that you think are of great consequence that we should all be talking about right now?
Well, I mean, clearly from our perspective, the issues associated with human rights, the protection of freedoms around the world, freedom of religion, freedom of expression, assembly, issues of democratic governance, the rule of law, these have to be, we believe, the central considerations for absolutely all countries going forward if we're going to create the kinds of societies necessary to be able to benefit from positive economic development and social development. From a Canadian perspective, we've been a founding member of this organization, the UN, and one the eighth most important contributor financially to the organization. So protecting our investment and making sure that there's value for that money that comes from Canadians is something that takes up a great deal of my time and the folks that I work with at the Canadian Mission. But we also understand that there are compelling issues of international peace and security at play in the world today, the situation in Syria. We're very concerned in Canada at the ongoing situation in Iran and the abuse of human rights in Iran with an election about to take place in that country, and Iran's behavior in terms of its nuclear ambitions that gives us all pause for very, very great concern. And issues in Africa, where we see many countries emerging from conflict situations, how to ensure that they don't fall back into those kinds of deleterious circumstances. These are the things that keep me and my colleagues here in New York working actively every day with and at the UN.
And good on you for doing that. Here in the United States, bashing the UN has become almost a sport, particularly among certain political groups, to the point that the previous president appointed as an ambassador to the United Nations a fellow who said that several floors of the UN building should be blown up. I'm curious if Canada has that same peculiar political strain, or am I wandering into territory that you're uncomfortable discussing?
Look, I think all of us around the world should question the way this organization performs, and certainly my government is not reticent about standing up and saying where it thinks the United Nations is falling short and where it thinks it needs to do better. But the United Nations is an organization of 193 member states, so it's not just that building that you see in pictures on the east side of New York. It represents all of us, and it takes takes the concerted effort of all countries to ensure that the organization is operating in a manner that's consistent with the ambitions and aspirations of the world. We come to the UN and we look folks straight in the eye and we say, you've got to do better. You've got to be more transparent. You've got to be more accountable. You've got to demonstrate results, concrete results, if you want to continue to have the support of countries like Canada in the kinds of things that you're doing. And, it's an imperfect organization. I think we have to accept that as a matter of course. And something that I read when I first arrived here in New York that's kind of stuck with me is that Dag Hammarskjöld, who was probably the best remembered Secretary General of this organization, back in the 1950s said that the United Nations was not created to take us to heaven. The United Nations was created to keep us from hell. And I think the reality is that the UN is dealing with tough issues, with tough problems. Sometimes it's going to get it right. Sometimes it's going to get it wrong. It's the only place where we do come together from all countries from around the world to try to bring critical mass to deal with the world's problems. We've had successes, we've had failures, but we've got to keep working collectively, because at the end of the day, the nature of the problems that we face as a planet can only be resolved and attended if we work as one and move in a direction that has consensus of the body, if you will, of countries of the United Nations going forward.
So very well said. Dag Hammarskjöld was, in my opinion, one of the. If we were to have a secular saint for the 20th century, he would be one of my candidates. His book Markings was such an important one to me. I gave away about 50 copies of it for Christmas some years back.
Absolutely, he gave his life for the world in terms of what happened to him on his mission in 1961.
Yes.
And he was a very thoughtful man in understanding both the strengths and weaknesses of the organization. But you know, we can never lose sight of the fact that the exhortation has to be there from all quarters, that the organization has to always try to do more, and that means being accountable, that means being transparent, that means being efficient, being able to measure the things that you do. And my government has no hesitation in calling the UN out when it needs to be called out to ensure that it does those things in an appropriate way.
Dag Hammarskjöld, also the second Secretary General of the UN after U Thant, wasn't it?
No, the first was actually Tyrveli of Norway.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, U Thant came after.
Okay, so he was the third. Thank you. He spoke of the UN sometimes in almost sacred terms, not so much the UN as the world and the importance of peace in the world that he felt the UN was protecting. Do you think that sense of we're all in this together, we've got to heal this world is still with us, and what can we do to bring it back? We have a little less than a minute left, sir.
Well, you know, the UN was created in the aftermath of a carnage that saw 20 million human beings perish in the Second World War. I think that the UN still is dedicated fundamentally to advancing the cause of peace and greater security in the lives of individuals. It does so from the point of view of pursuing peace initiatives, but it also does this through development initiatives in terms of those who suffer from hunger, those who suffer from disease. It is an organization that impacts in many, many different ways on the lives of people, with the intended and stated goal of trying to improve the lives of those people. Whether it's successful or not in every case, that's something that's subject to debate and needs to be taken seriously by the organization. But if it didn't exist, we'd probably have to invent something like it to be able to bring that kind of critical mass to bear with what are some very, very compelling and difficult problems that we face around this planet.
Well said. Ambassador Reshinsky, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Anything Goes Friday, back with your calls right after this, 27 minutes past the hour, right here on the Tom Hartman Program, tomhartman.com, for our new free app. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Anything Goes Friday. Alex Wagner is, I think, one of the smartest interviewers on TV, one of the smartest journalists around. She's got her own show now, I think it's called, with Alex Wagner on MSNBC. And she had Senator Jeff Merkley on today and was asking him basically, you know, what do you think about this data scoop? And he had a very, very cogent answer. Here are his thoughts.
If members of Congress have an issue with this, I encourage them to speak up. In your opinion, has the administration listened to members of Congress who have an issue with some of this surveillance?
No, the administration hasn't listened at all. We've asked for the rulings of the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court, about how it interprets it, the laws that Congress passed to be declassified so that we can have a conversation with the American people about that. For example, the question is, how is scooping up your cell phone data, which tracks where you are, my cell phone data, related to an investigation? That's the plain language of the law, related to an investigation. Well, certainly anyone would hear that and think, well, that's a certain hurdle that has to be met, that there is a crime or a potential crime or a potential national security threat that justifies scooping up your information and my information. Clearly, the administration has not followed what an ordinary person would consider to be the standard of the law here, and has not been willing to release the opinion of the FISA court about how they're interpreting that language despite repeated requests from Congress to do so. And I think there are many pieces of this that the president glossed over. He took very lightly the collection of very detailed information about who you call, who you talk to across America. He took very lightly the fact that that information involves where you are when, the tracking of virtually every American through their cell phone. He kept coming back to say the content of the phone call isn't listened to, but I think that we need to recognize what massive data is being collected on Americans that hasn't been public debated, that doesn't meet the standard of the plain language of the law related to an investigation.
There you go. Related to an investigation. And that's a law that, in my opinion, is overly broad to begin with. I mean, he didn't even have to get to the Fourth Amendment. He was just like, these guys have even gone beyond the law that we passed back when we were all, you know, being run roughshod by a group of terrified little men and one woman in the Bush administration. So we'll see how this plays out. There's another piece to this, by the way, that I think is really, really creepy and really worth noticing. And that is that an awful lot of this information that we're all hysterical about the government getting, your stalker next door neighbor, or your angry brother-in-law, or your employer, or your employee, or your ex-boyfriend or girlfriend, or you, I mean, you know, fill in the blank, right? Everybody's got somebody in their life that they'd rather didn't know all the details of, you know, what, who they're talking to, what they're doing, and the obvious low-hanging fruit, which porn site they've subscribed to. All that information is available without a court order by anybody because these organizations are selling it. It's like I keep saying about the NRA. The NRA is all hysterical about, oh, there's going to be a national database of gun owners. Well, hey, I'll sell you a list of gun owners. $30 a thousand. The NRA is selling them. I don't know if they're still that price, but, you know, that used to be the neighborhood of the price for mailing lists. And the NRA will sell you a mailing list of NRA members who are gun owners. The stuff, you know, it's publicly available. You have a positive pregnancy test, and the next thing you know, you're hitting websites that are showing you baby products. You're getting stuff from Nestle's in the mail. You may not have even told your boyfriend or husband or parents or whatever, but guess what? Corporate America knows. So, yeah, I'm very concerned that the government knows and that they're tracking us. I'm also concerned just in general about the total loss of privacy and anonymity that we are experiencing in this society. Chris in Ringgold, Georgia. Excuse me. Hey, Chris, what's up? Thanks for listening to Sirius.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Chris.
Can you hear me?
Just fine. What's up?
Okay. I just wanted to give a shout-out to you and Bernie Sanders. Thank you so much for working so hard for the working class.
Thank you.
I just want to make a comment before I have my question. For any conservatives out there listening, I am a working mother.
Oh, Oh, Chris, I am so sorry. I have a new touchpad, and I just touched it the wrong way in the wrong place, and I dropped your call. Please call back, and we will get you on. In the meantime, it flipped us over to Steve in Libertyville, Illinois, listening on Sirius. So, Steve, it's your turn.
Hey, Tom.
And I'll try to keep my hands off my trackpad here. Yes, sir.
First-time caller. A long-time listener, but I also want to say you're one of the most intelligent people I've listened to over the years.
Thank you.
And I have two questions or concerns that I'd like to hear your thoughts or feedback on. One is in regards to bringing jobs, corporate jobs, back over here to the United States. A thought as to increasing the tax level for those individuals that invest in a, let's say, a mutual fund that's an international fund as opposed to a dividend rate or a capital gains rate of 15%, increasing that up to something like 50%, whether it's a company that has a certain percentage of product or employees outside of the United States, same thing, increasing that tax to encourage them to bring that back to the United States. That's my first thought or question. And the second is in regards to the state of Illinois. I don't know if you're aware that the state of Illinois is in some financial issues. They just approved fracking in the state of Illinois. And while I don't agree with that,
just
I would
approve
like to
what?
See, they've just approved fracking in the state
fracking.
Of Illinois.
Okay.
And I don't agree with that, but if they're going to do it, why not, in order to solve some of their financial problems, do something like Alaska does, to where everyone in the state gets a dividend and additional funding goes to help pay out the debt.
So tax it and create a permanent fund. If we're going to use carbon fuels, and I don't think we should be, but, you know, if we were going to, that's a good place to start. Alaska has, the Socialist Republic of Alaska has figured that out. Excellent point, Steve. Thanks for the call. Anna in Chicago, listening on WCPT. Hey, Anna, what's up?
Hi. I listen to you all the time, and I like your show. I'm not against the government, you know, but I think that the government collects this information anyway. It always has in whatever form it does, you know, in the past. And
not so much, actually.
Well, you don't think so?
No. I, the government's been quite constrained in doing this. In fact, I was surprised back during the Church Committee hearings during the Nixon era. Basically, the government was only collecting this kind of information on people that Richard Nixon asked them to. He had his enemies list. But no, the government does not routinely collect this information, and historically has behaved, by and large, within the constraints of the Fourth Amendment.
Well, I agree with you in that regard, that they have, by and large. But I think since the age of the Internet, I think that that's gone out of the window. And I only say that because I look at all the information that's being collected by pretty much any company, you know, your cell phone company, your home phone, your internet provider. I mean, they have all this information on you, and they require more and more, and they keep this information. I mean, it's just a matter of time before they're going to broker it, you know, to the government for security. I mean, that's just my thinking.
No, I agree with you, Anna. In fact, I'll bet that, you know, the Google is saying, we never got a subpoena from the government, and the government's saying, we haven't built a trap door to the back of Google. I'm betting they didn't. I'm betting that there's some contract out there, you know, Acme Security Contracting Company, that the government said, okay, you know, give us the Google information. Here's $50 million. And Acme went to Google and said, okay, here's $40 million. Let us buy the information from you, because Google will sell it to anybody. And so there it is. That's why I said earlier, my concern is not just that the government is getting this information, but that it's so widely available that it could be. I mean, literally, it could be the stalker. It could be somebody who hears your voice, Anna, and thinks, oh, what a great voice. I'm falling in love with Anna. I'm going to find out everything about her. And off they go, you know, off to the races. This is, particularly a problem for women. And for talk show hosts who get stalked and harassed and death threatened and whatnot as well. Let me tell you about that. But our loss of privacy is significant. Do you not agree that that's a problem?
And I think that we should fix that, you know, first before
yes.
we would get to the government, because it's so out of control. It's, you can't do anything anymore. There's no freedom anywhere. And it's, I mean, I personally hate it.
Well, libertarians would argue that that is the definition of freedom, that if a company can do whatever it wants, if it can gather any information it can, if it can sell that information to anybody, if they can force you to click the little box that says, yes, I agree to the terms and conditions, that everything I own is now the property of this corporation, at least with regard to my interactions with this corporation, then that's freedom. I disagree. I think that that's the corporate marketplace, you know, doing things badly. But Anna, thank you for your call. Excellent point. And thanks for listening to WCPT. It's 2:15, 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more of Anything Goes Friday. And also, Nanette Brown is going to be with us with UN Women for a few moments in just about 5. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So has the administration stepped over the line? I think the Bush administration stepped over the line, and I think Congress plays a big role in it, and Obama's continuing it. Welcome back to 10 Minutes Past the Hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and we have a guest coming in from the United Nations. And do we have a Skype picture? Hey, welcome.
Hi.
Hi. What I have, on according to my sheet, is that Nanette Brown is supposed to be with us, but you don't look like Nanette. So
I am not Nanette Brown, okay. I assure you.
Okay, so can you please tell us who you are?
My name is Boaz Paldy. I work for the United Nations Development Program.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, Boaz, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us. For people who don't know what the UN Development Program is, you want to give us a quick explanation?
Sure. We are the largest development agency in the UN. We shepherd the United Nations and the world's Millennium Development Goals. We work to alleviate poverty everywhere in the world, and that's basically our main task, is the alleviation of poverty.
And how do you do that?
In many, many varied ways. We work to empower women whenever that's needed. We work on issues of climate change and environmental degradation where that's needed. So we work a lot on democratic governance, to build institutions of state, to make governments more responsive to their citizens, more transparent, less corrupt. That's some of the main things that we do.
How is the UN, Boaz, how is the UN Development Agency funded?
The United Nations Development Program is funded by member states. We have an executive board. They decide our strategic plan for 4 years, and then that strategic plan is brought to member states, and they fund us on a bilateral level.
Great. Well, it's marvelous work you're doing, and I thank you so much for joining us. And the website for your particular agency within the UN is what?
www.undp.org.
UNDP as a development
program. Development, yes. Development program.
Program. Thank you. Thank you, Boaz.
Thank you.
Great speaking with you. Thank you very much for being with us
today. Okay, bye-bye.
Fascinating stuff. We've got some great guests from the UN today. Chris in Ringgold, Georgia. Chris, are you the person that I hung up on by accident?
Yes, sir.
My apologies. Welcome back.
That's okay. I am down here in conservative hell, Georgia.
Okay.
So I just want to let everybody know that I'm not one that's looking for a handout. I do work full time.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But I've just recently gotten involved with the March Against Monsanto. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm very familiar with it. We promoted it 2 weekends ago when it happened internationally.
Well, yeah. It was just amazing to me how, you know, 3 or 4 days after the event, and the mainstream media finally put something on about it.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think that's all about?
I think that, you know, Monsanto is a big multinational corporation, and our news networks, including the cable networks, are owned by big multinational corporations. And big multinational corporations tend to take care of each other. You know, they're kind of part of a club. And so they're not going to publicize stories that make each other look bad.
Yeah, so, I knew that corporate money ruled a lot, pretty much everything, but it really kind of slapped me in the face after that. But, you know, there's so many platforms out there for you to get on. You know, there's so many issues right now.
Mm-hmm.
but I have just recently gotten involved with the movement Move to Amend.
Mm-hmm.
And I live really close to Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Yeah.
And so we have just become an affiliate.
Oh, great.
And I think you had a speaker on earlier. I think his name was Dan. And he was asking, you know, what can we do as Americans, you know, to help this problem, to get our word out?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's very hard for, you know, middle-class families, even, you know, all families, because we have children, we have jobs we have to go to. You know, we live paycheck to paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I just ran up a flight of stairs.
That's quite right. You're doing good for that.
Anyway, so the Move to Amend movement is huge, and I think that is very important for everybody to, you know, just get on the web and look it up. We also have pages on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is probably the biggest thing that would tackle a lot of issues. Do you think so?
I do. I think that the cancer at the core of our democracy or our republic, depending on which party you're a member of, is the dual idea of corporations having protections under the Constitution, which is nowhere in the Constitution, but the Supreme Court has decided, and that money is not property, that it's speech, another doctrine that the Supreme Court has created. And the only way, because the Supreme Court created these doctrines rather than the legislature or a president, the only way we're going to get them out of our body of law is by amending the Constitution to explicitly remove them. And movetoamend.org is is, in my opinion, the best organization doing that, because they're committed just to that. They're not doing 16 other things, and this is one of the things that they're doing as a way of getting publicity or raising money or something. They're just all about that, and they're creating groups all over the country, and I think that they're once we do away with those two doctrines, that corporations have rights under the Constitution and that money is speech, not money, or not property, once that's done, then state legislatures, city councils, the federal government, any legislative body can then pass laws regulating money in politics, donations in politics, you know, money being spent in political advertising, the ability of lobbyists to behave behave badly or well. There's so many good things that and certain amounts of corporate power can be ended. The ability of corporations to mess with elections. The ability of corporations to mess with you and me. I mean, it's just, these are the original sins right now in our society. So I'm with you. And, oops, she hung up. Shano said you were the winner of our book. It's Kim, right? Danielle has your phone number. She's going to call you back. Shano says that you have won a copy of Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, autographed by its author. That would be me. And so thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for raising the issue, and thanks for giving me a chance to go off on. So, and that, by the way, that autographed book will be brought to you courtesy of Stamps.com, one of our writers. Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back with more right after this. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything Goes Friday on our program. And, this is interesting. Doug, listening on TuneIn Radio in St. Peter's, Missouri, has some statistics for us. Doug, big data mining?
Oh, yes, sir. I've got an article in the New Foreign Affairs that was done by Kenneth Coker and Victor Mayer Schulenberger.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of interesting. He talks about how the explosion of data as recently as the year 2000, only one quarter of the world's stored information was digital. But that's the rest was preserved on paper, film, and other analog media. But now, because it expands so quickly, that today less than 2% of all stored information is non-digital. So that gives you an idea of just how far they're going to be able to go by using this data mining, macro look at it.
Yeah.
And it scares the heck out of me.
That's pretty amazing. You know, there's an upside and a downside to this too, Doug. Morris Berman wrote a book back, 10, 15 years ago. I think it was called The Twilight of the Elite. No, that was another book. In any case, Morris Berman wrote this book in which he suggested that because so much of the data in the world has been digitized, and if there was a nuclear war, the electromagnetic pulse from nuclear bombs going off in various continents would basically wipe clean all of these digital storage devices. All that data would be lost. It would be like the burning of the library at Alexandria. And his call for action, where there was just like this massive loss of thousands of years of information and wisdom. And his call for action was for people to form basically like monasteries, like the old monks used to sit and just copy manuscripts by hand and write stuff down or etch things into stone or into glass in a way that they will survive an electromagnetic pulse. They would survive the end of the crash of civilization so that future civilizations will have something to look back at. Thoughts?
Yes. Well, I don't think that that's going to happen because a lot of these, this building that they're putting out in Utah, I'm sure is going to be heavily protected from any kind of electromagnetic pulse
that
could be created and wipe out information. What was interesting about the article was he was talking about ways that they're using it now. And instead of looking at a specific fire that occurs in Chicago, instead what they do is they mine the information from the building that caught on fire. They, look at the wealth of the people that are there, the standards, the fire department, and all this other thing. And when they go out to send their city fire inspectors out to inspect buildings, they have a more accurate list of places that are at actual fire potential, and whereas they used to only get like 20% of the buildings that they would visit, that they could say, okay, well, you guys need to do this or you need to do that. Mm-hmm. They're talking about how now it's up to 70% because they've been able to find the traits that relate to this.
Right. Well, that seems like a reasonable use of data.
Yeah, the part of it, though, on going in and taking people's personal information, this is just a big fish net.
So this is an example of using the invasion of privacy to do something that seems good, but still there's an underlying sin, and that's the invasion of privacy, and we need to do something about that. Doug, thanks for a thought-provoking comment. Thanks a lot for bringing it up. Detroit Johnny O, watching on TV in Romulus, Michigan. Hey, Detroit Johnny O, what's up?
What happened to you? Is it the arm or the shoulder?
It's my shoulder, and I'm not sure if it's because we joined a gym or if it's because I've been typing like crazy for the last 6 months to finish a book, and I suspect it's both, but it's my shoulder and my
muscles.
Yeah, I don't know. It just hurts like crazy, and so if I keep it immobilized, it doesn't hurt. So.
Well, for the people, and myself, we hope you get well quickly.
Thank you. Thank you. I hope so, too.
Yeah.
I'm working on it.
I was listening to Amy Goodman and Ralph Nader this week about timeforaraise.org.
Mm-hmm.
August, you're aware of that situation, right?
Yeah, raising the minimum wage.
Some kind of a vote? Or is it a vote?
Well, the Democrats have been pushing this. The president called for it. He said, let's raise the minimum wage to $9. If we were to take it up to $10, it would be back in the neighborhood of where it was in the 60s. But he's meeting the Republicans halfway and saying, let's take it from 7.25 up to $9. And, it'll pass the Senate. But there's no way that the Republicans in the House of Representatives are going to raise wages on working people. They don't give a rat's ass about working people.
So it's not going to happen this year at all.
I don't think so. I don't think there's a chance. I don't think it's going to happen next year either. We're going to have an election that causes, even though the Democrats got 1.5 million more votes for the House of Representatives than the Republicans did, because the Republicans successfully gerrymandered so many districts in 2000, they actually control the House of Representatives, even though they got fewer votes. And so it's going to, you know, it's the old thing. You know, if they steal 5 million votes, you got to show up 6 million voters. We're going to have to get, you know, 1.5 million extra, you know, people, more people voting Democratic than Republican for House Representative races was not enough. We're going to have to get 2 or 3 million people voting Democratic for House races in the 2014 election. And, you know, that'll set the stage for the 2016 election. But if that happens, if the House flips Democratic from Republican in 2014 and the Senate stays Democratic and Harry Reid blows up the filibuster, then the last 2 years of the Obama presidency could be an extraordinary legacy. On the other hand, if all that doesn't happen, it's going to go the way of Harry Truman. You know, it's he's going to be sitting there for 2 years just fighting a bunch of Republicans and not getting much done. Now, Truman successfully turned that into a reelection campaign, but this is the second term of President Obama, so I don't think it's going to work out. But, Johnny O, thanks for calling and raising the issue. Jeff, in New Lisbon, Wisconsin, you wanted to talk about General Hayden. He was the guy who incorrectly, in fact, I think we've got the, I know we've got the quote, I don't know if Shane can easily find it, of General Hayden misquoting the Fourth Amendment, you know, back in the day.
Precisely. Quite the opposite of what you were, your knowledge of the Fourth. They ripped it up and burned it.
Yeah.
He was on C-SPAN.
Yeah.
He was wearing his four-star general thing before he became the head of the NSA. Now, may I ask you, do you know, is he still currently the head of the NSA? Because I'm
going to
take him to court in Mass. Do you know who is?
He is not. General Hayden is no longer the head of the NSA. I frankly don't remember who is, but General Hayden is long gone. Jeff, thanks for the call. Here's what General Hayden had to say in his testimony before Congress, if this is the one I'm recalling. Here we go.
But does it not say probably the court standard?
Actually, pause that for just a second. Let me just read you the Fourth Amendment, okay, so that you all know what we're talking about. How long is the clip? It's a minute, and we have until 1 minute till the break. Let's deal with this when we come back, because, you know, I want to do this right. And General Hayden getting it wrong is symptomatic of so many others getting it wrong. Cliff, we have just a minute to the break, but you have a quick question about pot and crack and heroin?
Well, the fact that it's a Schedule I drug, marijuana, which is the same as heroin and crack.
Yeah, it's absurd.
19 states that have medical pot. The one I wanted to say is that there's the U.S. government was awarded a patent on cannabis in 2003. It was on research done by the National Institute of Health, and it's assigned to the Department of Health and Human Services. So our government knows that there's the cannabinoids are useful in treating and preventing stroke and Parkinson's and Alzheimer's.
Yeah, absolutely. It wasn't a patent on cannabis itself. It was a patent on a particular cannabinoid. But you're right, and our government knows, you know, pot is medicine, and as well as being a very good recreational drug, and or at least far less dangerous than alcohol or tobacco. Let's put it that way. Thanks a lot for the call. Well said. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Coming up, General Hayden displaying his general ignorance, but it's really apparently symptomatic of what's going on across our government, even today. Welcome back, John Hartman here with you. It's UN Day, and we're bringing in guests live from the United Nations, and Ambassador, am I pronouncing it, is it Geir Pedersen?
I'm very impressed. This is very good.
Well, the reason why I know the Pedersen part is because that was my grandmother's name. My grandmother and my grandfather both were immigrants from Norway to the United States in 1917.
Wow, and, we should meet.
Yeah, my father is full-blooded Norwegian. In fact, we went back to Grimstad to track down where they, you know, where my grandfather's family came from.
Where did you say he was from?
Grimstad.
Ah, from Grimstad. Yeah. It's a beautiful place.
It is. Yeah,
absolutely.
A beautiful town and small town. Louise and I spent a fair amount of time in Norway. In fact, once in a moment of frustration years ago, I called up the Norwegian embassy and said, I'm half Norwegian. How do I, can I move to Norway? And they said, no, it's not that simple.
So. You give it a new try. You know, yeah. We should welcome you.
Yeah, there you go. So you are the Norwegian ambassador and permanent representative to the United Nations. Norway-UN.org is the website. Ambassador Pettersen, from your perspective, what are the issues from the Norwegian point of view and your personal point of view? What are the issues that the UN is addressing now of greatest import?
I think we should let me divide it into three. One is, of course, the fight for peace and security. And I think Syria, of course, is perhaps the most important issue.
Mm-hmm.
Then the second is the fight against poverty. And here we had last week the presentation of the so-called high-level panel. And the high-level panel is a committee that the Secretary General established
mm-hmm.
to look into how we can successfully continue the fight against poverty and sustainable development. And as you know, the LURD has been very successful in fighting poverty. More than 600 million people has been able to come out of poverty because of the work we've been doing the last 15 years. Mm-hmm. And the panel then recommended that our ambition should be to get rid of extreme poverty within the next 15 years so that 1.2 billion people could get out of poverty.
Yeah. This is good stuff. I'm curious with regard to Syria, and this may be a larger question than you'd want to address. Feel free to just tell me so. I look at this situation where you've got now Hezbollah, Israel, the United States, Russia.
Sorry, I missed you.
With regard to Syria, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, with regard to Syria, we've got all these different parties who have primary involvement, the United States, Russia, Israel, Hezbollah, and all of these countries have mutual defense agreements with other countries in the region and other countries in general. Is it conceivable, is my paranoia justified, that we might be looking at an Archduke Ferdinand moment? The thing that triggered World War One that people are still trying to, still scratching their heads over, how did that happen? Where a regional conflict can become larger. I'm not suggesting necessarily World War Three, but a much larger than it should be conflict.
I think there is the situation is extremely serious, and there is of course a danger that it could spill over from Syria to the broader region. Actually, we do already see some spillover. We see some spillover into Iraq. We have seen to Turkey, and we have indeed also seen to Lebanon.
Yeah.
But as I see it, it's not really a place where the Russians and the Americans are sort of directly confronting each other. But it is a place where parties would like to mobilize American support, Russian support, Arab support, and so on. So the different parties are, working very hard to get that. And as we know, the Russians are heavily behind Assad and the Syrian government. The U.S. is supporting humanitarian and politically the opposition. But I do not see sort of a danger that this should lead to a confrontation between parties outside of the region.
That's reassuring to hear. May I ask you a question about Norway?
Please.
I understand Norway has a national health care service.
Yep.
Everybody in Norway is covered by health care, so you don't have the problem that we have of half of all bankruptcies are because somebody got sick. Is there a political movement in Norway to end that, to say, hey, that American system, that's wonderful, we should do what they do?
No, I don't think so. I think in Norway, of course, there are health systems can always improve and be better. But in general, I think we are very pleased by the fact that we do have, a coverage that guarantee all of us.
Yeah.
And that, it doesn't depend on your income or your insurance, but it's guaranteed by the state. And this is, something that we learn from We Are Small, and it's not really controversial. What is a discussion, however, is that some would like to see that private institutions could play a bigger role within the overall system. Mm-hmm. And there has been a gradual adoption so that today you will also see private doctors, a little bit of private clinics, But the overall system is still in place and gives guarantees to all of us.
Yeah, marvelous, marvelous. I wish more Americans would travel around the world and see how the rest of the world does things. Because
I can tell you that, you know, sometimes, you know, people tend to believe that we are, you know, paying all we earn into taxes. We don't. But we feel that, you know, the taxes we pay, that we get a lot back from that. We get free schooling. You know, we don't have to pay to go to college or to university. We have, as a, you know, as you rightly mentioned, a free health system. So I think, yes, it's a good place to live.
Yeah, yeah.
So you are welcome.
Yeah, you have a very high quality of life there in Norway, and many good lessons to teach us. And you know, you rate very high in the quality of life scales, you know, by all of the indexes. So and Norway is also a very generous country in terms of your foreign aid. You're one of the larger per capita foreign aid contributors.
That's correct. We give 1% of our gross national product, and our priority, of course, is to give to the poorest countries. But we also work in particular to create this, you know, energy for all. You know, there are more than 1 point.
You can finish your thought.
Okay, there are more than 1 billion people that need energy, and we want to support that and continue to do that.
Yeah, very, very
Thank
good.
Thank you.
My possible distant cousin, Ambassador Geir Pedersen, the Norwegian ambassador and permanent representative to the United Nations. Sir, thank you for being with us.
A pleasure. Continue the good work.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. A pleasure and an honor to talk to you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We will be back with Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. Okay, I promised you I was going to share with you General Hayden speaking. This is when he was the head of the National Security Administration under George W. Bush, explaining to Congress what the Fourth Amendment meant. Now, let me first read to you the Fourth Amendment. It's one sentence long. It's very short. And I'll explain first what it says in my English, and then you can hear it in the actual English. And then we'll hear General Hayden try to explain it in the NSA's English. The Fourth Amendment says the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause. Okay, now this is your protection against unreasonable searches, but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized. And somehow General Hayden never got as far as that probable cause thing, and he simply said, well, it's whether it's reasonable or not. And no, this is the definition. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized. So here's General Hayden trying to have this conversation. Do you have the member of Congress that he was talking to in that? It's not okay. We'll see if we can figure out who this was that he was talking to. But this was his testimony before Congress back during the Bushy days.
But does it not say probable? The court standard, the legal standard,
search and seizure.
The legal standard is probable cause. My understanding is that the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution specifies that you must have probable cause to be able to do a search that does not violate an American's right against unlawful searches and seizures.
Fourth Amendment actually protects all of us against unreasonable search and seizure.
But that's what it says. The measure is probable cause, I believe.
The amendment says unreasonable search and seizure.
But does it not say probable? The legal standard is probable cause.
Just to be very clear, okay, and believe me, if there's any amendment to the Constitution that employees of the National Security Agency are familiar with, it's the Fourth, right? And it is a reasonableness standard in the Fourth Amendment.
Right. That was General Hayden. He was speaking with a member of Congress And it's been many years, long ago, far away. I'm sorry, I don't remember which member of Congress that was, but who kept trying to explain to the general that something's reasonable or unreasonable because somebody has sworn under oath that they have probable cause to believe a crime has been committed. And the general was like, well, if there's any one of the amendments that the NSA knows, it's the fourth. And then he completely gets it wrong. It's really quite extraordinary. James in Hampton, Georgia. Hey, James, what's on your mind?
How are you doing, Tom?
Fine, thanks for listening.
I know that you did not condone the capture of all the phone numbers. What I had a disagreement was when you had said that the president's obligation wasn't to protect us, it was to uphold the Constitution.
Well, he has both, obviously.
Protecting us from that fourth, you know, from the unreasonable search, which it was. It was, they had admitted this was a blanket search, and the NSA would then search through the numbers for their target. So they grabbed all of our stuff, and they were absolutely wrong. And I know you're not condoning it. I know you agree, but I do believe that the president does have more of an obligation to stop them from doing these things. And I had one more, was that...
Well, hang on just a second. Let's get to your one more in just a second. My assertion is that his obligation is to protect the Constitution. That's what it says in his oath. Not to protect you and me, but to protect the Constitution. And I agree with you that if he were to stop the NSA or other organizations from snooping on us, he would be protecting the Constitution, and thereby he would be protecting us as well. But first and foremost is protect the Constitution, is it not?
Right, and I think we both agree that the wide capture and the Capture Act has gone way past. This is 20 years now where we've had the government tells them, you know, if you go to a FISA court and nobody else hears about it and you agree that you can capture all this stuff,
yeah,
you can take all the emails, phone calls, and everything else. And, you know, this has been since 93, and nobody has fixed this since. But, I'm not insulting, I'm just asking, when you're trying to prove a point about what the government's doing wrong, not to sit there and go, George Bush started it 5 years ago. You know, we voted for a Democrat to do something other than what was going on before, and I get really upset with most of the shows that go, when the Republicans did it, they didn't have a problem. I don't care what the Republicans did. I care about not doing it anymore.
Yep.
And when we vote somebody else into office, it isn't so that they get their turn to do something wrong. And I really wish voters would appreciate that more. It's because we want better. We don't want our turn to do more or less of what somebody else did wrong.
Agreed. And very well said, James. And by the way, the rationale for the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the courts, the original FISA courts, was that to have an Article III court, a regular constitutionally mandated court, that would hear cases and decide whether or not a person's Fourth Amendment rights are going to be violated, whether under the Fourth Amendment it was legal to breach the security of someone's homes, papers, effects, and personal items, that there were circumstances under which that really could not be done in public, that there were circumstances under which that had to be done in private, and yet there was still a constitutional necessity for that third branch of government, the judiciary, to act as a check on that second branch of government, the executive branch, and say, yes, you may, or yes, you may, or no, you may not. And so those courts were established in the first year of the Clinton administration, although the push for that had been going on for a number of years. I mean, for a long, long time. Those courts were established in order to satisfy that requirement. I frankly don't have a problem with that. Do you?
I have a problem because when it started out, it was foreign numbers that had contact with U.S. numbers,
right.
Then you would investigate those U.S. numbers to see if there was a nexus of terrorism.
Right.
But the problem I have now is that they are capturing all of them. Prism.
Oh yeah, they've gone way beyond. You're absolutely right. They have gone way beyond their original charter. They've gone way beyond their original purpose, and I think they have wandered into areas that are frankly and bluntly unconstitutional.
We agree.
Okay. Thank you, James, for the call. I appreciate it. And whether it's done by a Republican or a Democrat, frankly, doesn't matter. Kathy in Valparaiso, Indiana. Kathy, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Direct TV satellite system. What's up?
Oh, I have to turn my TV down because I have you on now.
Thank you.
I was calling because of what you were discussing about the internet and all that.
Mm-hmm.
The government is eavesdropping on everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But what I wanted to go back to is the closing of the post office. If they do that, see, they have to get a warrant to snoop in your mail.
Right.
And nobody's mentioned that yet. That I on the shows that I've been watching.
Oh, that's interesting.
And as I told Danielle, I said I'm putting on my foil hat because I get laughed at for all these conspiracy theories. But if anybody put it together, that the big corporations like Apple and Google and all of them are not supposed to be paying their taxes. Do you think that they already knew the government was snooping and are just washing each other's hands?
Well, it could be, or it could be that they're just selling the information to, you know, for-profit contractors who are selling it to the government.
Right. I used to work in the state of Indiana as a peon, and this stuff I've been saying this for years.
Yeah.
And people, oh, you're just a conspiracy theorist, and laughed at me. You know, you're just crazy.
Yeah.
But all this, I just hung up from a friend of mine. I said, what's scaring me is it's happening at warp speed now. I was talking about this stuff in the 80s.
Yeah. Yeah, well, see, you know, it's like the conservatives scream about big government. They're freaked out about big government. Liberals are freaked out about big corporations. I'm freaked out about both. Freaked out is the wrong word. I'm concerned. I think that we need to have constraints on both. There is a size beyond which corporate America, corporate behavior, international corporations become dangerous to liberty and freedom. And there is an area of intrusiveness which violates, in my opinion, the Constitution, where government itself becomes an agent not of great good. It's funny, the cartoon over on the homepage of Democracy or Democratic Underground right now has President Obama and the President of China sitting next to each other. And President Obama says, we are very, very concerned about how you are spying on your citizens. And the President of China says, you know, LOL is in the thought balloon, you know, or the word bubble out of his mouth. But it is both government and corporate behavior that concerns me and that I think that we need to be addressing. And Kathy, I don't think that you're
right.
A conspiracy.
Right. But my other point was we used to say with government, it becomes like I used to work for Child Protection Service.
Mm-hmm.
It become a living, breathing entity on its own.
Yeah.
Makes my hair stand up on my arms just mentioning now to you.
Well, Child Protection has incredible power too because they can take children away from their parents.
Oh, honey,
with
it was
very minimal.
While I worked there.
Yeah.
I could tell you horror stories you would not believe. I've lived them.
Yeah, no, I would believe them because for 5 years I was the executive director of a residential treatment facility for those kids, and I saw it happen. Occasionally, you know, frequently in ways that were useful and good for kids, and more frequent than should be in ways that were, you know, dangerous or destructive for the kids. So, Kathy, thank you for the call and excellent point. Thanks, and thanks a lot for watching us here on Free Speech TV. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And check out our app, complete with Sue's Daily Stack and all kinds of our daily blog, all kinds of cool stuff. It's free. You can get it over at TomHartman.com. Welcome back. Hey, special thanks to Jeff Holtzman of the Talk Radio News Service for coordinating all our guests from Radio Row at the UN. We're going to get to that in just a second, but first our Friday thanks. Thanks to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to all the various organizations and companies that syndicate our program, Dow Global on commercial stations, Pacifica Radio on non-commercial stations all across the United States, Europe, and Africa, on Sirius XM Satellite Radio all across North America, on CRN Network, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show as television, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, all the others around the country, to all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room, hey, to Alan Ratner, Victoria Jones, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, and to Jay Goodman-Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, our underwriters, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. Now, all that said, Sarah Crowe is on the line with us. She is a spokesperson and senior media advisor to the executive director of UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, as if I'm remembering the acronym correctly, Susan, or Sharon.
Or Sarah.
Sarah. Let me write that down. Thank you.
Or Tom.
Thank you, Sarah.
You're welcome. Yes, you've got it right.
Okay. So what is UNICEF up to these days? What are you working on?
Well, I guess what weighs heavily on our minds today is, of course, Syria, as we've launched together with our UN partners, one of the biggest, in fact, appeal in the UN's history. And simply because the situation is escalating at such a pace that the humanitarian assistance just cannot keep up. So of course, and children are suffering and bearing the brunt as no other single group. We've seen, we were in the region of Jordan and Lebanon not too many months ago, and speaking to children there, and of course if it was television I'd be able to show you some drawings that I brought back, what children had seen and what they paint and how they view this horrific crisis, and it's truly heartbreaking because they're seeing things that no child should ever see.
Oh, my. We are actually, about half the people listening to you are actually watching you on television right now, and there's a camera off to your side. If you want to hold any of those pictures up, feel free.
Right. I'll get them in a second, okay, if we can have those drawings.
We're talking to Sarah Crowe. She's the Senior Media Advisor to the Executive Director of UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund. And UNICEF.org is the website. And you've also have a new study out on violence against indigenous girls, adolescents, and young women. Can you tell me about that?
Right. Well, perhaps if I now have those drawings, if you want me to hold them up.
Oh, sure.
I don't know how clear that's going to be.
It's off to your left. Yeah. The camera's off to your left.
So. Okay. I don't think we're going to get it.
Point them at the microphone and we'll get them.
So. Okay. There we go.
There you go. Yeah, just a little bit higher. Perfect.
Right.
Okay. Oh, my. Yes, these are things children should not be seeing. Airplanes and bombs and blood. Yes.
Exactly. UNICEF has been there throughout and before the crisis. But I suppose the greatest tragedy with Syria is that this is a country that was doing extremely well for its children. You had nearly universal primary school education, and in the case of just one particular town, Aleppo, which you've all heard a lot about on the news, there's only 6% of children going to school there. Oh. So it gives you a sense of the scale of the problem. One of the biggest operations that we have on the ground in Syria is delivering water, and now we're coming into the very hot summer months, of course, and this is an extremely dry, arid region, and water is life-saving. So we are doing what we can, but of course it is unraveling at such a pace that no one agency can keep up, and it's in nobody's interest to continue this horrific war.
That is, yes, that's absolutely tragic. Do you see, well, I guess UNICEF isn't involved in the negotiations and things that might bring that war about, to an end.
No, we're not. And of course, children don't vote and don't sit on the Security Council, and we try to be their voice, the voice of the voiceless, if you like. And what we're doing is of course immunizing, giving temporary schooling, repairing damaged schooling, and it's not just in Syria, but it's also in the surrounding neighboring countries where you have up to 1.6 million refugees. So it's affecting an entire region, and that's of huge concern.
Are there still large quantities of children as refugees from the Iraq conflict?
Well, interestingly enough, there are Syrians going into Iraq, and those drawings that I showed you were, in fact, children from Syria who'd gone into Iraq. So Iraq is one of the hosting countries. And, what was remarkable when we were there is to see how the host communities in the neighboring countries are welcoming in these refugees, but it's putting a huge strain on the neighboring countries as the population rises, the refugee population, and of course you've got Syria emptying out. So it's a regional crisis now.
Yeah, absolutely. Sarah Crowe, the Senior Media Advisor to the Executive Director of UNICEF. We have just a little less than a minute. You do have a new study on violence against indigenous girls, adolescents, and young women. Do you want to speak to that?
Yes, I certainly could. We, you know, part of our, certainly our executive director, Anthony Lake's big focus is really refining UNICEF's mandate to focus on what we call equity and creating, trying to reach the hardest to reach children. And of course, indigenous children are some of the hardest to reach because they're often in isolated areas.
Well, I wish you the very best. UNICEF is doing God's work. I mean, you're doing great work. And thank you so much
thank
for being on the program
much.
Today.
Thank you, Tom.
It's an honor, Sarah. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, we'll be back Monday. Have a great weekend. Coming up Monday, the latest news and information from the weekend, along with any breaking news on the NSA spying scandal, plus creationism in the classroom. One school district in the Heartland is considering teaching it side-by-side with evolution. I'll have a debate with creationist Dr. Joseph Mastropalo, who says there's no scientific evidence for evolution. Right. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. Check out free-don.com.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.